sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Thomas Harding, author of the new book, Hans and Rudolf, the true story of the German Jew who tracked down and caught the Commandant of Auschwitz. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Recently I read a book that explores the question, why are Jews so smart? While this might seem like mere bragging for a people dedicated to exceptionalism, we do call ourselves Am Segula, the chosen people, after all. It turns out that there's a great deal of empirical evidence that Jews are, in fact, pretty bright. You faithful to Jewish listeners should already know about us Jews winning 22% of all Nobel Prizes, even though we are less than a quarter of 1% of the world's population, that we have 3 of the 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices, that for the past several decades the head of the Federal Reserve has been Jewish. We all know about the tremendous overrepresentation of Jews in the fields of medicine, technology, finance, law, academia, entertainment, government, music, and of course, comedy. But why should this be true? Two academics, Zvi Eckstein and Maristella Bottacini, explored the question in their book, The Chosen Few, How Education Shaped Jewish History. Their answer is simple but revolutionary and based in history. After the destruction of the Second Temple and the beginning of the long exile from Israel, the survival of the Jewish religion demanded that every single Jew had to learn to read and write and to acquire knowledge acquisition skills. Whoever was unable to do so assimilated and simply stopped being Jewish. So out of necessity, we Jews found ourselves possessed of skills that proved critical for our own economic development and that of every place we have lived in since. In other words, historically, we were faced with a choice. Invest in the substantial cost of effectively educating ourselves and our children in learning and teaching Torah, or give up being Jews. The Jews who made the choice to emphasize education created societies with universal literacy, knowledge of mathematics, and the ability to think in higher ways, in abstract ways. Those traits and skills turned out to be ideally suited to the developing economies of the world, and likely always will. But more importantly, that deep commitment to learning extended to every area of life and created a society of Jews dedicated to learning and growing in all aspects of life, Torah in the broadest and most meaningful sense. That commitment is still central to what it means to be a Jew, and that lifelong dedication to Torah, to learning and growing as Jews, is now part of our DNA. It is what makes us special, not chosen in the sense that we're better by some divine gift, but special in the ways we dedicate ourselves to the ideals of learning and knowledge as central to our identity. So long as Jews continue to dedicate themselves to the pursuit of education and truth, we will continue to be, as God promised Abraham some 3,800 years ago, a blessing to all the peoples of the earth. Now, that's not to say that Jews are naturally smarter than others. It's just that so long as we continue to focus on education as the centerpiece of our culture, we will remain intrinsically valuable to any society we find ourselves living in. When we don't, well, then we become much like everybody else. Not bad, but ordinary. It's the ability to see that Torah, sacred and perhaps even secular Torah, the dynamic process of learning, teaching, studying, discussing, and exploring every important idea and text, is at the heart of what makes everything good and new possible in society. I'm reminded a little of a book I read a long while ago called A Hole in the Heart of the World. It was about the Jews of Middle Europa, the center of Europe, the region where the Habsburg Empire once had its capital and had its greatest influence. Parts of Germany, Austria, the Czech lands, Bohemia, Hungary, Slovakia, Romania. That book described the fact that this area was the greatest center of ideas and culture in the whole world for close to a century, that it produced earth-shaking thinkers like Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Albert Einstein, among many, many others, in politics, physics, medicine, psychology, music, art, theater, and literature. Many of the greatest developments in human thought and creativity originated in this diverse little region of Middle Europe. But with the coming of the Holocaust and the elimination through emigration and slaughter of nearly all the Jews, the culture of that region went from being the most dynamic and creative in the world to, well, nothing much. Eliminating the Jews of Middle Europe more or less ended its extraordinary and remarkable creativity. You see, it's those same Jews, or at least those who fled and survived, and their descendants who helped make New York and Hollywood the new centers of creativity for both high and popular culture in the world for quite a while. All because of a Jew's dedication to education, learning, creativity, what I would call Torah. When Jews are in the mix, creativity, learning, growth, all happen. And when we're out of it, not so much. You know, the virtues of Torah. Speaking of Torah, yesterday we began chanting the Torah again, beginning with Bereishit, Genesis. This week we'll chant the famous story of Noah, beginning with evil acts, an ark, 40 days of rain, a flood, and then continuing on to include a raven and, most memorably, a dove. To play us in this morning on the theme of Noah, here's the classic Israeli singer Moti Kaspi singing his song, Noach.
Noach, lo shachachnu ech bagesher uvasa'ar. Noach, la'teva asachta ech hayot hayar. Shtayim shtayim mikol min, ha'arye ve'ha'mamuta, ha'gamal ve'ha'shibuta, ve'gam ha'ipopotam. לשוט על פני המים נוח כל החלונות סגורים כמעט חודשיים וכבר אין לנו אוויר לאריה ולממותה לגמל ולשיטוטה וגם להיפופוטם פתח לרגע את הצוהר ואל תוך התכלת הלבנה שלח את היונה
והיא הוא אותה כולם מהארגה והעממותה הגמל והשיבותה וגם האיפה פותה תחת לרגע את הצוהר
That was Israeli singer Moti Kaspi and his classic song Noach. Send out the dove, he urges this truly ancient mariner. We'll have more about Noah a little later in this show. You know, after the Garden of Eden story and the Exodus tale of the crossing of the Red Sea, I suspect that Noah might be the single best-known biblical text and character of all. It's probably the combination of all those animals and that rainbow. With these symbols, you get everyone from preschool kids to college co-ed dorm rooms. And once you toss in that dove of peace, you have another oft-used universal symbol. Tons of marketing opportunities for the manufacturers of toy animals and rainbow pillowcases and bed throws, too. But like so many biblical tales, there's more to this story than meets the eye. It begins, after all, with people doing evil. And it ends with more people doing more evil acts in spite of the flood and the ark and the dove and the rainbow. The real message is that we need something beyond mere symbols or leaps of faith to motivate us to be decent, good human beings on a consistent basis. We need the structure of justice and morality that the Torah ultimately provides. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, author Thomas Harding, who's written a fine new book about his great uncle, a British Jewish soldier who managed to capture the Commandant of Auschwitz, the greatest mass murderer in history. Find out how he did it when we return on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, author Thomas Harding. He has had an interesting and varied career, a former documentary filmmaker and journalist, wrote for the Financial Times and The Guardian in England, founded a TV station in Oxford, and an award-winning publisher of a newspaper in West Virginia, lives in Hampshire, England. He attended a great uncle's funeral and heard a very interesting, well, story that he didn't know that led to the book Hans and Rudolph. Tell us about that experience, if you would.
Well, it was 2006, and I was listening to the eulogy for my great-uncle Hans, and much was familiar. The family, they were in Berlin. 1930s, they moved to England. My great-uncle Hans, he joined the British Army, and he went to Belton at the end of the war. But there was one thing that that my cousin said during the eulogy, which took me by total surprise, that my great-uncle Hans, at the end of the war, was a war crimes investigator, and he tracked down and caught the commandant of Auschwitz.
Wow, not a small accomplishment. As you describe in the book, he didn't seem like a remarkable guy. why. How did that transpire? It was the end of the war. He was in the British Army. Give us a little bit more of the background on how he ended up tracking down Rudolf Hess.
So this is Rudolf Huss, the commandant of Auschwitz, and he's often confused with Rudolf Hess, confused with Rudolf Hess, the secretary to Hitler, who ended up in Spandau.
Right.
But at the end of the war, Rudolf Huss, he actually left Berlin with a whole bunch of the guys who ran the concentration camps and went to the northern border of Germany, where, on the border of Denmark, and they were basically told by Himmler in this meeting, just meld into the population, just take on somebody else's identity. And so during that time, Rudolf Huss was working as a farm laborer. He planned to get to South America. His family was nearby. And in the meantime, my great uncle Hans was given the task of tracking him down. And in March 1946, the local British field security section arrested Rudolf Huss's wife, and my uncle interviewed her, interrogated her, and said, listen, if you don't tell us where your husband is, we're going to ship your son to Siberia. She then revealed his whereabouts, and that night they went in for the arrest.
What's fascinating about the book is you trace the origins of these two guys. Well, obviously very different backgrounds. Explain sort of how you decided to construct the book that way.
Well, at the very beginning, I was interested to find out my great uncle's story, because of course I have a personal connection, and I was inspired by the idea that he left Germany but then chose to come back and to face his persecutors. But the more I got into it, the more I became fascinated by Rudolf Huss's story. How does someone become the commandant of Auschwitz? What decisions lead to that? He became perhaps the greatest mass murderer of all time, overseeing at least the death of a million Jews in Auschwitz. You know, this terrible, terrible person. And at first, I thought of it as Hans, my uncle, and then Huss, you know, the other guy. But the more I got into it, the more interested I was in the human side. And at first I found that quite scary, because it was easier to see him as a two-dimensional monster, as a character. But then I was determined to really look into it a bit more, and I tracked down the family members of Rudolf Huss. And they gave me an insight into who he was and the decisions that had led to him becoming the commandant and what he was like on the private side. And I found that absolutely fascinating.
And I think our listeners will too when we come back on Too Jewish with author Thomas Harding. The book is called Hans and Rudolf in just a few moments.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming them from twojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. This coming week in Temple, we'll read the great Torah portion of Noah about the most famous sailor in history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark, from a forgotten Broadway show on the theme of Noah called 2x2 that starred the late, great Danny Kaye. It's about what happens when you finally get off the ark, a delightful song called When It Dries.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, you're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, it's gonna be some terrific place, you're gonna see wide and open space, we're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries, the world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries, the greenery's gonna have a shine, the world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third mine,
half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare
when it dries,
with drinkable water everywhere,
when it dries, there's gonna be air beyond compare, with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there, when it dries,
when it dries,
when it dries. To survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. Remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path, remembering how he vents his wrath,
that when he got mad we took some bath.
When it dries.
That was the song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2, with music by one of the most successful of all Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. Of course, Rodgers was Jewish, and his most famous partners were the Jewish Lorenz Hart and the descended from, but not raised as a Jew, Oscar Hammerstein. In any case, the great tale of Noah is shared to one degree or another by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh. Another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. But rather than read to you an ancient Akkadian, I thought that Bill Cosby's version of the Noah story would play better on the radio.
You see, Noah was in his rec room sawing away. He was making a few things for the home there. He's a good carpenter. Vuba, 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 vuba. Noah. Somebody call? Vuba, vuba, vuba. Noah. Who is that? It's the Lord, Noah. Right. Where are you? What do you want? I've been good. I want you to build an ark. Right. What's an ark? Get some wood. Build it 300 cubits by 80 cubits by 40 cubits. Right. What's a cubit?
Let's see, a cubit. I used to know what a cubit was. Well, don't worry about that, Noah. When you get that done, go out into the world, collect all of the animals in the world by twos, male and female, and put them into the ark. Right. Who is this really? What's going on? How come you want me to do all these weird things? I'm going to destroy the world. Right. Am I on candid camera?
That was Bill Cosby talking about Noah. There's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big boat with a whole bunch of animals. And yet, like Noah, we all must try to perfect this challenging and often broken world in which we live, whether we do it with a gigantic wooden ark or in much smaller ways with mitzvot and acts of tzedakah, ethical actions and charity to those who have less. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Violence is always in the news. International violence, whether it's involving Syria and civil war or Egypt or Iran. I read a very interesting article about nonviolence recently that said that the reason nonviolence works is because of the threat of violence. You were in the State Department a long time. You know a great deal about this. Let's talk a little bit about that idea.
Well, before we went on the air, you were talking about a domestic case, which is Dr. King preached nonviolence.
Sure. It was the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington not too long ago. And the article said that the reason that King's nonviolent approach worked in America was because of the larger threat of National Guard. There was a federal government that could enforce through force the rights of African Americans, and he provoked the violent response intentionally.
It went both ways, because in the 60s, some of your listeners may be old enough to remember this, there were sort of violent uprisings in predominantly African American parts of big cities,
yeah, riots,
that looked like they might approach civil war. So there was a threat of violence from both sides,
sure,
in fact,
absolutely,
behind the rhetoric of nonviolence. And that was kind of the same with Mahatma Gandhi. There was the threat of potential violence against the Brits, even though he preached nonviolence. But I think internationally, I mean, the case we always looked at was during the Cold War, the two sides, and specifically the U.S. and the USSR, built up these huge nuclear arsenals, which could have destroyed the entire world many times over. And it was like, why do you need this? Balance of terror. It was the theory that the threat of being destroyed many times over by an armed to the teeth other side would deter you from doing anything that might cause the other side to use those weapons, even if you could retaliate, because that means the end of both countries, basically the end of life on this planet as we know it. And it worked. By and large, it was successful. As we started finding ways of drawing down and going de-escalating that terror, which would have been state-sponsored terrorism in its purest sense, we developed confidence and security-building measures of all kinds, military, civilian. I mean, I could go into detail for hours about this, but basically these measures, CSBMs for short, enabled each side to feel comfortable dismantling certain weapons, disabling certain weapons, lowering the threat level in general, but still having enough that the threat of violence remained a potent weapon to ensure that violence wasn't used.
You know, it was that whole concept of MAD, mutually assured destruction, great acronym, of course. And yet, ultimately, that confidence only exists when you have the confidence that nobody's going to randomly just destroy you. Do these methods, and maybe this is too much for today, are these kinds of confidence and security building measures, would they be applicable in, say, the situation of Iran and Israel today?
Yeah, I mean, I think once you get to a certain amount of trust and dialogue, you can apply similar sorts of measures in any situation. And I think one of the points of that film we were talking about last week, The Gatekeepers, is talk to anybody, because only by having contact and sharing meals and whatever and getting to know the other side can you even begin to build enough trust to talk about establishing a regime of confidence and security building measures.
Great points. Tom, we will talk next week. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A modern classic this time. One day, a gorgeous woman gets on the bus, clearly distraught, and sits down next to a guy. She's visibly upset and can contain herself no longer. Finally, she turns to the guy and says, "I just saw my therapist, and he says, I have a big problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. She says, "I can't tell you. I don't even know you." The guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to just tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." So the girl says, "Okay. My therapist just told me that I'm a nymphomaniac, and I only like Jewish cowboys." It feels better. "By the way, now that you know, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Hello, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well, and don't forget to ride the bus. Now a word of Torah. It's an old story, and we know it well. God sees that wickedness and corruption have spread throughout the world, that human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, getting big bonuses for doing the wrong thing, you know, all the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in a deluge. One man is chosen to survive the flood because the Torah text tells us he was righteous in his own generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family about him and two of every animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something to sacrifice to God if they actually make it, Noah builds an ark, loads the boat, and goes not on a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity. Eventually, he sends out first a raven and then finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove brings back that famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. A great covenant is affirmed, the first and most enduring breed in human history. God agrees never again to destroy the earth by flood. We agree to abide by certain minimum standards of morality. Truly, a new beginning. In essence, God acknowledges that this new world will not be the Garden of Eden anymore, but it can be both physically and morally good and rich. Noah, we are told, was a righteous man in his own generation, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation, but it does set a reasonable standard that we can live up to. If we can't succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own turbulent times. All that's required is that we try to be the best we personally can be, that we seek to be moral and good when we can choose not to be. If we can do that, if we choose to be no better than Noah, we too might end up saving the world. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, author Thomas Harding, will tell us how the capture of the Commandant of Auschwitz by a German-born Jewish-British soldier happened and what it meant. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In minor clashes during the holiday of Sukkot last week, Palestinians threw rocks at Israeli security service personnel in the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and at Joseph's tomb in the West Bank. Several people were injured and the Israelis made some arrests. Oy. During the terrible al-Qaeda attack on the mall in Nairobi, Kenya, Africa, last week, Israeli advisors joined American and British experts in helping the Kenyan government and military to deal with the terrorists. Israel has more than 15 years of close cooperation with Kenya, most of it undocumented, working against Islamist terrorists in the region to both Kenya's and Israel's benefit. So it's no surprise to see that level of assistance continuing to come to a black African country from Israel. Israeli and American investigators continue to help the Kenyans in their inquiry into the terrorist raid and its aftermath. In a continuing sign of the softening of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic verbiage coming from Iran, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last week classified the Holocaust as a reprehensible crime against humanity, but added that it's up to historians to reflect on its dimensions. Rouhani struck a tone that departed dramatically from the outright Holocaust denying of his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. "I've said before that I am not a historian," Rouhani said, according to his translator, "and when it comes to speaking of the dimensions of the Holocaust, it is historians that should reflect on it. But in general, I can tell you that any crime that happens in history against humanity, including the crime the Nazis committed against the Jews, is reprehensible. Whatever criminality they committed against the Jews, we condemn. Taking a life, and it makes no difference whether that life is a Jewish life, Christian, or Muslim, for us it is the same." But Rouhani went on to add that such a crime does not justify usurping and occupying someone else's land. This, too, is reprehensible. Rouhani's statement is certainly a marked departure from that of his predecessor, who regularly denied the Holocaust even occurred and hosted conferences of Holocaust deniers and neo-Nazis. Whether Rouhani's more moderate tone will continue and what impact it will have on the West is unclear, but it is certainly a very welcome change and a clear signal from Iran that it is adopting a new approach to both America and possibly Israel. Israel so far is not having any of it, noting that Rouhani spoke at a military rally in Tehran just before coming to America last week to make his remarks, and that at that rally there were huge signs calling for Israel's destruction attached to missiles capable of reaching Israel. We will see. And Apple's new iOS 7 operating system, like its predecessor, lists Jerusalem without a country. Jerusalem is one of only three cities so listed in the World Clock app on the Apple without a country. The others are Vatican City and Taipei. The iOS 6 operating system's World Clock also listed Jerusalem attached to no country. Palestinians claim Jerusalem, really all of Jerusalem, even though a lot of it's never been Arab, as their capital, even though it's the capital of Israel. Hebron is listed as being in the Palestinian territories, as is Gaza, not a country at all. But somehow, Apple can't manage to put Jerusalem in Israel, where it is, was, and always, God willing, will be. Perhaps eventually, even to Apple. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews round the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author Thomas Harding. He's here in America from England promoting the book Hans and Rudolph, the true story of the German Jew who tracked down and caught the commandant of Auschwitz. We started discussing, you know, how this was your great uncle, who seemed like kind of a normal British Jew, tracked down maybe the greatest mass murderer in history. But the story evolves in your book, as you note, two very human stories. Huss's story is interesting because has a sort of a terrible childhood, really. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, he has, I would say, not a bad childhood. You know, I mean, his father is domineering. He's very religious, Catholic. He is living in this rural area, but certainly there's no excuse for his later behavior. You know, I think it's, you know, we're all tempted to, like, look into childhoods to explain what happens later, but actually, by the standards of the day, it wasn't bad. You know, they lived in a nice house. I think his father was probably strict and his mother wasn't very attentive. He runs away very early on to the First World War at the age of maybe as early as 14 years old.
Incredible.
And ends up going to what we call Iraq today, fighting on the German side with the Turks against the British, ends up going to Jerusalem. And after the war, he stays in the paramilitary. He's obviously committed and gets something out of kind of that brethren, the kind of brethren in arms, and ends up fighting in Latvia and gets embroiled with that very right-wing paramilitary kind of, group after the war, and ends up actually in jail for the murder of what he calls a traitor. And then in the 1920s, then 1920 comes out and is very much at a loose end. And, you know, is he going to go into politics? Is he going to stay in the military? But actually, he ends up on a farm. And this is the first time he finds, and according to his memoirs, which he wrote later on in prison, when he's waiting for his own trial in Poland in 1946-47, he says that this is really the first time that he found peace. And he really enjoyed being on the farm, met his wife, had started a family. And then the person who ran the farm suggested they set up a stable for the SS, this emerging force. Rudolf Huss thinks this is a good idea, but to run a stable, you've got to join the SS. So he joins the SS, and he's at some parade ground, and this guy called Heinrich Himmler comes up to him, who he also knows from earlier on, and Himmler says, listen, Rudolf, I'm very happy you're having a great time, and, you know, send my regards to your wife, but you've got to step up now. You've got to join me now. I want you to train as a prison guard. You need to come down to this new place I've just set up outside of Munich. I call it a concentration camp. We hold political prisoners, and it's called Dachau, and I want you to come down and learn to become a prison guard. And that's actually how he starts in that whole new system, where he becomes an increasingly powerful guard, then officer. Eventually, in 1940, he's invited to set up this new camp in this place called Oświęcim in Poland, which had been occupied by the Germans in 1939. That's what we today call Auschwitz.
Does he know when he's setting up Auschwitz that it's going to be for the extermination of human beings?
No, absolutely not. At first, it's for political prisoners. Mostly, these are partisans who've been resisting the German occupation. But very soon, he is called down to Berlin and has this historic meeting with Himmler, where he's told he needs to enact what they call the final solution of the Jewish question, what we now today know as, you know, the beginnings of the Holocaust.
Right, the Shoah.
And he's, you know, he's asked to design. He's actually asked to come up with what they call a solution to this mechanized killing, and he goes back and designs with one of his staff members this new way of mass murder using Zyklon B gas.
It was Huss himself who came up with the idea. Was it somebody on his staff?
Yeah, so one of his staff members basically, you know, was experimenting because to them they were trying to come up with a, you know, what they called an efficient way of murder. They knew that they couldn't kill a lot of people by shooting them, which would be what they had tried on the Eastern Front, you know, in Ukraine.
Right, with the Einsatzgruppen and so.
Exactly, because they had witnessed that the soldiers who had done the shooting, they had this emotional trauma. So they wanted to come up with a way there was distance, kind of almost mechanize it. And this person, one of his staff people in Auschwitz, came up with this idea of using this gas, which was basically a pesticide gas. And they tried it on some Russian prisoners. And then Rudolf Höss said, okay, that works, but now we need to come up with a way of disposing of the bodies. You know, this incredibly awful, gruesome conversation. And then also to take it, you know, to organize it away from the rest of the prisoners, not to cause any kind of reaction. So they then, you know, they created these fake showers in the crematorium in the second Auschwitz camp called Birkenau, and gradually it became a bigger and bigger operation. And within a short amount of time, they could murder 2,000 people an hour, which is, you know, beyond imaginable.
And then they went ahead and did so. I want to come back to your great uncle. Grew up in a comfortable life in Germany before they had to leave. Tell us a little bit about that background.
Well, I mean, he was a troublemaker. You know, he came from a very affluent background. He was a twin, so he and his twins would always cause trouble, swapping in and out of classrooms at school,
pretending to be each other, all kinds of stories.
Exactly. You know, they had his father was this very well-known physician. He was actually head of the Berlin Physicians Association. His clients included people like Albert Einstein, some of the Nobel Prize-winning scientists. He was the official doctor at the Deutsche Theater. So you can only imagine the most amazing people in and out of this very expansive apartment in West Berlin.
And that might have been the heart of the intellectual world at the time. So he really was exposed to all of that.
I mean, totally. I mean, to think, you can only imagine how wonderful that is. He himself was more into the movies, and so he used to kind of like go into lowbrow movies and ice hockey. So there's a sports palace nearby, and they used to watch the ice hockey games. And even when the Jews were forbidden, they would kind of dress themselves up as good Nazis and go in so they could watch their favorite players, because they were real committed, to watching the games. And then 1936, they had to leave, and, you know, they were able to get out. Most of the family was able to get out. And he was very much, you know, somebody who didn't take life too seriously. He had this good life. And I think it was only when he arrived in Belsen in 1945, in May, very, very shortly after liberation. You know, I mean, it was just unimaginable what it was like. There was corpses on the ground, and there was people walking around totally starved and very sick, that he had one of those kind of moments in life where the light switch just turned on, and he became incredibly angry and driven, and I think he found a new purpose. And extraordinarily, he was asked to interrogate, because of course he knew German, interrogate these people who had actually come from Auschwitz, the senior officers who had ended up coming from Auschwitz to run the Belsen camp. And so in many ways, he was the first person to hear the stories of what actually happened in Auschwitz, in terms of he was interviewing the commandant of Birkenau, Joseph Kramer. He was interviewing the guards, people like Irma Grace, and even the camp doctors who'd done the selection. So my uncle was hearing these unbelievable stories, you know, absolutely terrible stories. And I think he was just became filled with righteous anger, and you can only imagine, you know. And he went to his commander and said, listen, I want to go out and find the people who are still on the run. And his commander said, no, you've got to stay here and continue interrogation. So my great uncle, being the kind of guy he was, he said, okay, went out the door, and the next day he took a car and started looking for these guys.
You know, you describe him walking the streets of his old neighborhood in Berlin and asking about people, and everybody had been sent to camps in the east. There's nobody that knew him anymore, because they had all been slaughtered, and most of them at Auschwitz. It became very personal for him at that point, for Hans.
It became very, very personal. And, you know, one of his great aunts was missing, and he went to Frankfurt to find her. She ended up actually being deported to Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia, and ended up very soon after that being sent to Treblinka, you know, this other camp in Poland, where,
of course,
you know, Auschwitz was a mixture of both a labor camp and also an extermination camp. Treblinka, it was just extermination
at Treblinka, right?
You know, he was trying to find out where she was, and all these friends and family that he grew up with. And, you know, West Berlin was very much a Jewish neighborhood. You know, he would know all the shop owners, he wouldn't know the neighbors, and, you know, there's just nobody there. And, you know, his own house had been destroyed, his father's clinic had been destroyed. But he was there on a mission, so he was actually, I mean, even though he was there and he took the time to find out what was going on in his own neighborhood, you know, who wouldn't? But he was also out to find the trail of the people who ran the concentration camp inspectorate. So he was going around, you know, the American intelligence officers, and trying to find out, you know, what they knew about this thing, and went into the press agencies trying to find old photographs of these people, because it wasn't easy. I mean, you can imagine what it was like. Berlin was in chaos. The transport system was a wreck. It was not an easy time to try and track anybody down. And, you know, the people who he'd speak to, they weren't necessarily that willing to help.
When he finds Rudolf Höss, it's not you know, he needs to prove his identity. Can you describe that scene? Because it's quite a scene.
He's found out from Rudolf Huss's wife where Rudolf Huss is staying. He's taken on the identity of this sailor, this guy called Franz Lang, and he's in this tiny little village 4 kilometers away from the Danish border, so right at the very top of Germany. And it's very late at night, it's about 11 o'clock at night, and he arrives with a bunch of other British troops in a couple of trucks, and he walks into this very, very small farmyard, and he knocks on the door of this barn. And this guy answers the door, and it's Rudolf Huss. And my great-uncle puts a gun in his mouth and says, "You're Rudolf Huss, aren't you?" And the guy says, "No, I'm not. I'm Franz Lang." And my great-uncle shows the photograph he has, and he says, "Look, it's obviously you." And the guy goes, "No," and he shows his identity papers. So my great-uncle then looks at his arm, because, you know, they have the SS, they have the tattoo of the blood type on their arm, but he'd removed it. Many of them did. So he's looking around, and he sees his finger. And because he's German, he knows that often in Germany, people have their wives and their own initials or names inscribed in the wedding ring. So he said, "Okay, give me your wedding ring." And the guy goes, "No." You know, Rudolf says, "No, I'm not going to." So my great uncle says, "Okay, that's fine." And he asks one of his colleagues, says, "Go to the kitchen, please, and go and get a knife. I'm going to cut this guy's finger off." Mm-hmm. And Rudolf says, okay, I better give you." So he gives him the ring. And of course, inside are his initials and his wife's initials. And that's how he determined that it was, you know, he was the commandant of Auschwitz. And then, you know, being the kind of guy that he is, he and the rest of the troops drove into town to hide her. I mean, this is one of the most wanted men in Europe at the time. He's like the ace of spades. He should have just delivered him to the prison and started the interrogations, but instead of that, he left them in the truck in Haida with maybe one or two people, and then he and the rest of the guys went into a bar and proceeded to celebrate, you know, the latest capture, you know, because that was the kind of guy he was, you know. And after a few drinks, he took Rudolf Huss out of the truck, took the blanket off, and made him march across this enormous main square. Snow's on the ground. It's very, very cold. In the middle of the night now, maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, and makes him walk naked across the square to the prison, because, you know, he's obviously wanted to humiliate him.
You know, obviously it's nothing compared to what Huss did. What's interesting is that Huss decides to talk after that.
Well, I think this is really, really important. So, during the arrest, my great uncle was surrounded by British soldiers, many of whom were either Jewish, British Jews, or refugees. Their families had lost family members in one of the camps. And they'd actually brought a box of axe handles with them. They were intent on, you know, doing great harm to Rudolf Huss. And my great uncle made a decision to allow them to do that, but not kill him. And that was definitely a decision. It was a very key decision, because Rudolf Huss went on to give testimony at Nuremberg. He was a witness, and it totally changed the momentum of the trial. For the first time, there's a senior member of the leadership, somebody intimately involved with the death camps, who was willing to say, "This is what happened. Here's what happened with the gas chambers, the crematoria. Here's actually the way we organized it." So it was absolutely critical piece of evidence for the Holocaust and what happened. And it changed the momentum, so that the other senior leaders, like Hans Frank, the governor of Poland, then actually said, "Okay, this is what happened. This is what we did." So it was absolutely critical that he'd been arrested and not killed, which you can imagine how tempting that would have been for the guys, for my uncle and the rest of the guys. But he chose not to and handed him over. And so his testimony is, you know, of incredible historical importance.
You know, it's a fascinating story told extremely well. The book is called Hans and Rudolf. It's available at Amazon and everywhere else. I want to thank Thomas Harding for a fascinating visit here on Too Jewish. Again, Hans and Rudolf, the true story of the German Jew who tracked down and caught the commandant of Auschwitz, an important chapter in the Holocaust and an important chapter in understanding. After all, he was responsible for the death of 2 million people, most of them Jews. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods.
Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Professor Shaul Magid, exploring and explaining just what post-ethnic Judaism is. Our playout this morning comes from Noah once again. Actually, this time it's a totally different Noah. Israeli-American singer-songwriter Ahinoam Nini, known as Noah, and her lovely song Now. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Now there is light coming in through the crack in the door. Now there is hope where I'd never expect it before. Now there are so many things, but there's nothing at all. Now you are learning to stand. I am